I want to apologize. I'd like to apologize ahead of time. Next week is going to be an interesting shiur. Just wanted to let you know.
And you have to apologize.
This week, feel free to just fall asleep. next week, we start to actually get to the Shoftim. We actually start to talk when we talk about Atniel. Although the truth is, we pretty much in the first year, I'll cover them just a little bit next week, because we covered Atniel to a certain extent. I guess I'll leave that where it is. We covered Atniel to a certain extent, all about how he was an attempted melech, but not. And then we'll get to Eru ben Gera, our assassin, and we'll have lots and lots of fun. But until then, I think it's important to lay a foundation for what's going on in Sefer Shoftim, and why Shmuel HaNavi wrote it, and whether Shmuel HaNavi wrote it. And I think what's very important, honestly, is understanding via maps exactly what's going on. First of all, because I guess I'm a, you know, I think as a Zionist, it's important to understand what the topography is both now and then. And also because I think it helps us understand the overall geopolitical situation that was happening in the Shoftim. There are two things I want to introduce first of all about Shoftim before we get into the map work. One is a Shofet is often confused with a prophet or a spiritual leader. This is not what a Shofet is. A Shofet is a military or political leader. It happens to be that if you were doing well, your Shofet was also a prophet, such as Devorah, such as Gidon, or at least a spiritual type of guy, such as Ehud, or such as, I guess Otniel would certainly be a solid Shofet that would have had some spiritual effect on the people as well. Dvorah specifically says that he shaftar beitahi, and that gives the impression that she's a political leader. But we see that she also communicates with God. But one should really keep in mind that many of the Shoftim, if anything, they were the exact opposite of spiritual leaders. They had some serious spiritual problems, to say the least. Avimelech, Shimshon, Yiftach. So we're going to need a lot of people who are effective as political leaders. And it should be understood that that's what a Shofet is. A political leader, a general, a military leader, sometimes a spiritual leader, most often not. The second thing which is important to understand is that the problem of Sefer Shoftim speaks really about a philosophical problem that needs to be discussed in a different forum, really. But the question is tribalism a good thing? That is, why did, especially in modern times, the idea of tribalism seems just sort of waiting for civil war and for disunity among the people. Why did God then go out of his way to create tribal units if the idea was to integrate these tribal units into one nation state? That I'm not even begin to answer. It's just too large of an issue. We'd have to do too much work we'd have to study the Shoftim, the original brothers, and it really would take a lot of work. But what I want to say, though, is the problems that arise from Sefer Shoftim are in fact this kind of factionalism. Yehuda is pretty much out of the picture. The other tribes don't even bother talking to Yehuda because they know they're out of the picture. When Devorah will get to Devorah, when she starts singing her song and yelling at all the tribes that didn't come, she doesn't bother mentioning Yehuda that did not come. It was Yisrael to the north and it was Yehuda to the south. So immediately there's a division among Yehuda to the south and the tribes to the north. But even among those tribes, we'll find that there's a great deal of factionalism. The reason why the Shoftim stayed Shoftim as opposed to becoming Melech is because every single one of them, except for Gidon, failed to integrate all 12 tribes. And Gidon could have succeeded had he not rejected it outright. And we'll have to figure out exactly what that means when Gidon says, I refuse to be the Melech. But he was at least the offer was on the table. We don't know whether Yehuda was playing along or not, but the assumption is everybody else was certainly playing along. The offer was on the table.
Why do you say that Yehuda is part of the picture?
Well, we don't. Yehuda had essentially set up a separate kingdom to the south from Yerushalayim to the south. Devorah doesn't speak about them because she had no expectation that they would come up and fight Devorah's war. They had their own problems with the Plishtim and the Amalekim. They had their hands full and they were considered separate. Yehuda did not, in fact, come up to fight Devorah, but as opposed to every other tribe that didn't come to help Devorah, that she really gives, I mean, she sings quite nastily about, Yehuda's left out, not mentioned in neither good nor bad. Essentially, she talks about 11 tribes and not 12. Well, she doesn't talk about Levi, so I suppose 10 tribes and not 11. They're simply left out completely. Why that is, we'll get to when we get to Sefer Shmuel, because that division will persist. Nonetheless, it's something that one should... they participate essentially in nothing except for Yehuda-oriented things. Otherwise, they are really separate from the Jewish people. Again, I just want to solve these problems, we're going to have to learn a lot more Tanakh. Just to keep in mind that the Shoftim, A, were not spiritual leaders, and B, they often did not have power outside of their immediate area. So while it says, Dehem Shaftu et Yisrael, Bekoshi, barely. Some of them were more successful, and some of them were far less successful about even uniting their own tribe, no less other tribes. We'll find, if you remember, Yiftach winds up killing, I don't know, what is it, 10,000, 20,000 of his cousin tribe of Ephraim, in the most dastardly way. So that's the sort of symbol of the exact opposite. Not only did they unite, but they actually divided. Therefore, that really gives us a preamble for the maps. I'd like to go back to chapter 1. And chapter 1 mentions all kind of places that B'nai Yisrael, if we go back to Sefer Korset Shokin, we go to chapter 1, we touched on these things from the philosophical sense, what it meant when they did not conquer the nations around them, what it meant when the nations dwelt among them, when they dwelt among the nations, what it meant to have a tax on the nations. We consider that from a spiritual standpoint, but today I want to look at it, one of the two things I want to do, is look at it from a political or geopolitical idea, and that's why I brought the maps. And I think we have a few more still. I think there may be another one on the table. The first map area that we find, which is not conquered, and I'll ask you to open to the second page on that. The second page on the map looks like this. Let me turn this a little to the side. The second page on the map looks like this. So you got a map on top, which is Yehuda's territory, and the map on the bottom, which is Dan's territory. So if you look on the Yehuda territory, if you go up to nearly the top of the page, you'll see Yerushalayim, which is below Beit El. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. Yerushalayim is the northern border of Yehuda's territory. Yericho is in Binyamin's territory. Half of Yerushalayim is in Binyamin's territory. Essentially, Binyamin is directly to the north. You won't notice Debir here. Debir is halfway between Hebron and Be'er Sheva. And Be'er Sheva is on the Besor River, or the Shore River. I think it's the Besor River down below. Be'er Sheva is essentially right at the end of the mountains. Arad next to it was another place that was mentioned that was conquered. Bezek, by the way, if you remember, we mentioned Bezek. Bezek is really a sister city of Yerushalayim. It's not on this map, but it's immediately to the east, or towards the Jordan River. So in Pasuk, when it talks about the areas that Yehuda did not successfully conquer, I mentioned it yesterday, but I want you to see how significant those areas are. It says, surprisingly, in Pasuk Yud-Chet, in chapter 18, it says, Vayokod Yehuda et Azah, they conquered Azah. You can see Azah at the bottom section of that map. Azah is the same place where the modern-day Gaza is today. That's the Gaza Strip. Vayokod Yehuda et Azah v'et Kvulah, and its borders. V'et Ashkelon v'et Kvulah. So Ashkelon, I'm sure you're familiar, you move up the map, I would say about... I would say probably halfway between Azah and the Shorek River, but maybe a little bit, not quite so far. Probably around where the Chet is, where it says Chof Hayam. Ve'et Ekron ve'et Gvulah. Now Ekron, again, I'm sorry the map I put it out didn't have all the places. Ekron is essentially sort of equal to Gaza, but it's closer in. It's much closer to Lachish. Where else did they conquer? Vayhi Hashem et Yudah v'yorsh Tahar. So they conquer the Har. Where is the Har? If you take a look, the Har, you can see the word Tahar right next to Chevron. If you take a look at Chevron, immediately to the left of that, you'll see a Hay and a Resh. That's Tahar. It's what we think of as the Judean Mountains or Yehuda. They are, by the way, for a topography standpoint, they are about 350 meters tall, or about 1,000 feet high. That's the topography. Anybody who's driven up to Yerushalayim is actually about 50 meters lower than the Gush Etzion Mountains, the mountains of Hebron, but by and large, if you've driven up, you know, Israel, going over that massive mountain where you have to put it down into thirds to really get any kind of motion up that mountain, that's pretty much what you're talking about. It's a good 1,000 feet climb. It's not an immense mountain, but it certainly has some significance. Vayhi Hashem et Yudah vayorish tahar, ki lo lehorish et yoshvei ha'emek, ki rechev barzelahem. Ha'emek is fairly clearly labeled, which is what I mentioned yesterday. Ha'emek is to the left, and that's what we think of as even more than the Gaza Strip. Today, the Gaza Strip is only a small portion of Ha'emek. And I think from this map, you can get there three levels. Ha'har is at the top. Then you have the Shvelah. Do you see that right to the left of that? To the west of that is the Shvelah. The modern cities in the Shvelah would be Gat, I think. As you're driving down the road, I suppose the Beit Shemesh area is already down a little bit towards the Shvela. It's probably a little bit sort of in between the Shvela and Yerushalayim and the mountains. And then once you get down off the Shvela, you hit the valley. And as you can see, it's a significant portion of territory. It's a significant portion of territory. I'm going to show you how it even gets more significant as we go along. So essentially, the entire Amic area was not conquered by Yehuda, not because they didn't want to. The Torah takes specifications. Shmuel makes specifications because they simply had weapons. They had weapons that were not matched by the Jewish people. And God was not going to have them conquer them, which brings an interesting philosophical question. Why not? God could do anything. Why not make the weapons fall apart? We're going to touch on that today. That's going to be something we'll discuss after we do the map work. But of course, it's a very important philosophical discussion, and the Ramban deals with it in Sefer Shmot, and that'll be one of the last things that we do today. Except for the Amic, Yehuda was successfully conquered all the territory. Now the question is, how far to the south? And as I've mentioned before, the south doesn't go quite as far south as you think it does. The southern territory of Israel, the southernmost border, was Kadesh Barnea, which is where the Jews sent the Meraglim from. That would be, just at a guess, because it's not on the map, it would be about...
It is.
Where's Kadesh Barnea?
Last thing on the left.
Yeah, that's... Should I be honest with you? That's a little bit low. But it's okay. Which puts it around the Mitzvah Rimon area. Down if you... On the lower left-hand side. Oh, that's good. I believe that's a little bit low, but it's pretty decent. Which means that if you slide along...
High.
What? It's pretty high.
Politically.
Yeah. It's a shocker, right? You think, wait a second, can that possibly be the southern border of Israel? I thought Israel goes all the way down to Eilat. No Eilat? What am I going to do if I don't have Eilat? But the truth is, twice in the Torah, does it mention that that is in fact the southern border. In Bamidbar, you have a Tanakh. Oh yeah, in David's time. David conquered it way down to a lot. Oh, absolutely. David conquered it. Even, yes, during David's time. No question about it. I'm not saying that it didn't become political Israel. I'm saying that the original definitions, it was not part of the political Israel, and that I've got to expand on a little more. But I'll read to you, this is from Bamidbar. This is God talking through Moshe to us. V'nasav lachem v'ul minegev l'malei akvarim. Oh no, where is it? It's phone. There it is. The Nasavachem Gvul Minegev L'Malei Akrabim V'Avar Tzina. That's Midbar Tzin. V'Yat Totzaav Minegev L'Kadesh Barnea. V'Yat Zachatzar Adav V'Avar Atzmona. Atzmona, which we know today. That's not a lot. It's way north of Olo. It's next to Atzmona and south of Arad. Probably is a settlement town down there. It's kind of a very poor settlement town. I forget what it's called. Yerocham, maybe. Yerocham, Demona. That's the area. Also, what's interesting is when God promises the land to Abram, he just says that he's going to give him all Kol Eretz Canaan, but it leaves us not knowing exactly what Eretz Canaan is. Show you a little bit of perfection of the Torah. In Parshat Noach, and most people miss it because it's in the boring part where they're going through he begat him and he begat the other guy. So out of nowhere it says, Uknan yalad et Sidon v'chorov et chayf, that they receive et amriv et gashis. We have all of the Canaanite kids. And the last two psukim are by Yehi Gvul Aknan Sidon, that's from Zion, which is, I don't know, 20 miles north of the current Lebanese border. Boacha Gerara, Ad Aza, so take a south down to Aza. Boacha Sdoma, so take a line from Aza over to Sdom, Sdom being a little south of the Dead Sea. Va'amora Va'amora Tzim Ad Lasha, and then Lasha takes you all the way up back to Dan, where up to the Golan Heights. We're talking about a rather small view of Israel. Now, it's a famous Rabbi Yoel ben Nun piece. There are actually two borders of Israel, because the other border, of course, which is famous, is Menachal Mitzrayim Ad HaNahar Prat, which is a massive border. So Rabbi Yoel ben Nun goes into the idea of greater Israel, which is a philosophical concept. What Rabbi Yoel ben Nun is saying, spreading the monotheistic belief up to the borders of the Euphrates and Mesopotamia, and down, but not including to Mitzrayim. Those would be the big three civilizations. But practically, civilization-wise, the Jews didn't own much until David's time, past Be'er Sheva, and up to the Golan Heights. How do we know that? Because whenever it talks about Shmuel, for instance, which we'll get to in a few months, it always says, V'hu yada kimo navi meidan ad Be'er Sheva, meaning that the primary civilizations of the Jewish people were between those two areas.
when Don was not here on the coast.
When Don was up north, and we're going to discuss, and we discuss what that means. Yeah, Don's a big issue, which we're going to discuss, but not yet. We'll discuss it when we get to Shimshon, because Shimshon was the only shelter from Sheva Don, and we'll discuss exactly what Don's issues are. Now, Don, actually, while we have the page open, if we go back to Shoftim, it discusses Don as being the worst of the tribes, of the worst of the tribes to get their land. So if we go back to Shoftim, Perek Aleph, what does it mention? Don, Perek Aleph, Pasuk,
30,
yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. Vayichaltsu, they pressured them. Ha'amoriyah, b'nei Don Hahara, they pushed them right into the mountains. Kilometanola, redet la'emek. Once again, we have an emek. Vayol ha'amoriyah, la'shevet b'har cheres, u'ba'ayilon, u'ba'shalvin. And by the way, shalvin today is pretty much the same shalvin as it was then. Here, too, I have a map that's on the lower section of this area. You'll recognize the Yarkon River on the top. You see that? That's on the second page. It's a small insert, well, it's an insert at the bottom right-hand side. And you're looking at Nachal Don, you're looking at Don. Up above, you see the Yarkon River. Of course, the Yarkon River is what runs through North Tel Aviv. If you've ever taken that road down to the beach on Tel Aviv, so that it really essentially is a bridge right over the Yarkon River. The Yarkon, unfortunately, was also the river that, if you remember, the Maccabean games about 4 years ago, the bridge fell. They fell into the Yarkon River. It was polluted. That's the Yarkon River. I'm sure you probably smelled a lot better back here in the map than it does today, but it's a bad pollution joke. Shalvim, you'll notice, is pretty much all the way up in the mountains. You see Shalvim, if you go halfway down the map, you see the big words Don, and then you go down, I'm sorry, I don't have like a mileage. If you go down to one of the main cities, you see Yabniel and Yifton and Balad, if you take a right and go up into the mountains, you'll find Shalvim. That's almost up in the Har area. And that's pretty far up there. So essentially, if you put together the Amek of Yehuda and the Amek of Don that they don't have conquered, essentially you've lost the entire beach area. The entire beach area. From, essentially, from Azal all the way up north until you're really getting to, Herzliya, or maybe further. So you've lost this area. Why is that important? I'll show you now if you turn the page back to which page would be best. You know what? The best page would be the last page, which says Muhammad Devorah at the top. And now, if we go back to our psukim, before I discuss why losing that entire entire beach area, you know, besides tourism, why that's such a big deal. So if you go to Perek Aleph and we talk about Yosef, you can find Yosef's problems in Pasuk Chav Zayin. Let's start with Menashe. Menashe, this would be chapter 1, Pasuk 27. Menashe, lo horish Menashe, Beit Shan. Now here it goes into a great deal of detail. At Beit Shan v'epnotea, at Tanakh v'epnotea, at Yoshvei Dor v'epnotea, Yoshvei Yivraam v'epnotea, Yoshvei Megiddo v'epnotea, v'yol ha'kanayi l'ashev v'aretz hazot. V'hi k'chazak Yisrael, when they managed to be strong, v'yasem et ha'kanani l'mas, v'horesh lo yishu, but they did not kick them out. Where are all those areas? Well, you know what? Actually, the best place first to show you is on the first page. If you flip back to the first page.
What's the deal with the Epinotea?
Oh, Epinotea would be suburbs. I'm sorry I didn't translate. I apologize. Thank you for asking. And please, sometimes I really rely on Hebrew, so if I say something, stop me. I tend not to, sometimes I don't notice. When you talk of an ear and Epinotea, it means the ear and the buildings it has built, and what that means is outlying areas. Which means not only did they not conquer the city, but it's significant. Not only did they not conquer the city, she could say, okay, they didn't get the city because it was a walled city. They didn't conquer the area around it. So the question is why? And the answer, as we discussed yesterday, is because they really weren't that interested in it. They were mas, and they were reasonably satisfied with the mas. But there's another reason why they had a problem with it. Here, if you take a look, you can see on the first map on the top left-hand side, you can see some of these cities. To the left, you can see Megiddo. Do you see where that is? A little bit below that. Do you see that? It's below Nachal Kishon, which has become very important in Devorah's time. A little bit to the southeast of that, you'll see Ta'anach. I can tell you where Beit Shan is. If you go over to the east and you see a place called Meroz, I believe Beit Shan is a little bit further along in that valley area. So go a little bit more east along the river and head south a little bit. All of these cities that are mentioned are in Amic Yisrael. Now take a look at the area of Don on the left-hand side. You see that area of the Amic on this front map, which is also flatlands? Essentially, there was no control over any of the flatlands. There's two problems here. One is, in Israel, you may see cuts through Israel like a knife. You see that? It's essentially a big rift in Israel. To the south of it is Yosef and Yehuda. To the north of it are all the other, are most of the other tribes. You have Yisachar, Naphtali, Zebulun, Asher. So what you've created essentially is a political separation, a necessary political separation, because the entire valley area is owned by the enemy. I remember during the Golan Heights, when I was in the Golan Heights and we were having a lesson, I was in the tank corps, and they were discussing the Golan Heights War, 1973, the Yom Kippur War, and the Syrians came cutting through the Golan Heights, and they cut through like a hot knife through butter. Nobody was expecting them to come through, and they cut through so fast that they actually came close to reaching Emek Yisrael. And that had to be stopped at all costs, because once you get tanks down there in Emek Yisrael, you have a hard time getting rid of those tanks in Emek Yisrael. Tanks have a very hard time in mountains and mud, but they love flatlands and valleys. Hard to get rid of a tank. I realize it sounds like you can easily lob stuff down there, but they could also lob stuff up as well. It's not easy to unentrench tanks, and that's going to play a big factor, because of Sisera's main game was, of course, his chariot that he brought to play just in this area. So what you have in the situation, Devorah's time, we'll get to it, is essentially Israel is cut in half, literally separated. Try getting a message. Well, they didn't have television. They didn't have telephone. If you want to get a message to the northern tribes, you'd have to go through absolute Arab enemy territory. Today, we can unfortunately begin to understand that. It'd be like having to drive through Shechem in order to talk to anybody on the other side. But picture Shechem as not one city, but as the entire Jezreel Valley. Think about that. I mean, there's really no way through. And that puts Israel in a major geopolitical risk that Devorah will solve, but you can see where that causes a problem. The second reason that causes a problem is because this road, there is a road, I'm sorry, it's in Pritchard's atlas, has some beautiful maps of roads called Derech HaMelech. Derech HaMelech were these roads that were essentially international thoroughfares, and they were used for trade. A major Derech HaMelech went through Mitzrayim, up through Dan, up through Yehuda's Dan, up the coast, and of course cut over there on Nachal, I can't tell exactly what that Nachal is, but right below the Gidol, if you notice, there's a little passageway through, went through the Jezreel Valley, and then up into the Yom Kineret area, and then into the north, so you could get to Mesopotamia. So it was a loss of, essentially, you had people traveling through that were not under Israel's auspices. You had armies traveling through, and you had money traveling through, honestly, economically. You had essentially you had a bypass through Eretz Israel. So what you're talking about here is a great, during the time of Shoftim, until the Emek Yisrael Valley would be conquered, you had a major risk to Israel geopolitically as well as economically. And socially, of course, we've seen. On the last page, just to give you a last hint, and we'll stop there with the maps and then get to the problem that we raised last time about why the nations remained in Israel. Alright, it's a slightly bigger picture of Emek Yisrael. If you notice, you can see Har Tabor. You see that little, you see where it says Yisachar on the last map on the lower left-hand side? So right next to the first Sin in Yisachar's name, you see a little round mountain. See that guy? That's Har Tabor. If anybody's driven up, like, through Beit Shan, going up to the Golan Heights, you remember there's, like, this really weird, like, a perfectly round mountain. So that's Har Tabor. To the right of it is Beit Shan, to the left of it is to the west of it is Megiddo and other areas. So here you get maybe a little better impression about how the Emek Yisrael really cuts Israel into two. And on the top map, I just did this, it didn't come out so well. This is the Battle of Sisera, but this is a topographical map, and I'm sorry these things never come out so well. But if you notice those lines above the Jezreel Valley, what you're looking at is the plains of the Jezreel Valley. Essentially, they're close, but they're not exactly at water level. I mean, they're maybe 50 meters, 60 meters above water level. Do you see how fast the incline is? Every line is a 10 meter increase, I think. So if you notice some of them, there's so many lines. You see Har Tabor to your right there, right in the middle, all the way over to the right. You can see Har Tabor essentially goes straight up. And so does, essentially to the north of this is the Galil HaTachton. You're essentially the Galil. The Galil is taller than the Judean hills and the Sumerian hills. They're quite big. So if you get a sense, I get tired when I think about hiking, because I get tired just looking at that. Essentially, it's an incredibly steep incline straight up. And that's why this is really such a risky area, because you have to come directly down into the valley. They're like walls, essentially, to your valley. And that's why the valley is really well protected. It's not easy. It's not like you have an easy slope down to attack. It's cliff, and then you're there on the battlefield. Good luck. Good luck to you. And that's what Dora will have to encounter, and that's some of the things that we will discuss as we go along and we get into the actual showcase. So that's essentially it as far as map work. Just got to get a picture of what's going on. I skipped a few of the cities that were not conquered by Zvulun. They're up in the Golan Heights, and they're interesting, but I think enough map work. Let's get back to the actual problems of the car shop. Peric Bet will be the focus of today, and I raised the issue last time that we had, but now I want to see whether I can solve the issue that we raised, which is, we have a little bit of a contradiction. If we look at Peric Bet, the second chapter, the first passage, it says, Vayal Malach Adonai Minag Gilgal El Habochim, an angel of God, and here I want to stress that the word angel I'm using incorrectly. A malach is a messenger, more than likely a navi, who is on a message from God. That's the general usage of the word malach, and I could go into a bunch of proofs on that, but hopefully you'll take my word for it. Probably it was a prophet. Chazal have him as Pinchas. The famous Pinchas who never dies. Why is it important? As I mentioned very often, the Medrash is very rarely meant to be taken literally. It may have been Pinchas, it may not have been. That's not why Chazal tell us that it's Pinchas. They have a purpose in telling us why it's Pinchas, and we have to look at Pinchas's history to fully understand why. But I want to hold off on that right now and just sort of continue on, keep in the back of your on the back burner. Vayomer ale etchem min Mitzrayim, I raised you, I took you out of Mitzrayim. Vavi etchem el haaretz asher nishbati l'avotechem, I took you to the land that I promised to your father, to your forefathers. Vaomar lo afer briti etchem olam, I will never break from my promise. My brit is, my covenant will never break. The Atem, your side of the deal, and all of this, by the way, is back in the Torah and Parsha Emor, and the Tochcha, and Kitavo, and Emor. The Atem, lo tichrutu brit liyoshvei ha'aretz hazo, do not make treaties with them. Mizbechotehem, titotsun, you shall destroy their altars. Velo shamatem bekoli, you did not listen to me. Mazot asikem, what are you doing? It's a really emotional kind of thing. The Gama Marti, and I have also said, lo gareish otam mikinechem, I will not get rid of these nations from before you. Vayulachem l'tzidim, they'll be for you like hunters, maybe. Many the commentators have trouble with this word tzidim, but let's say they'll be for you like people who hunt you down. Ve'elohehem yiyulachem l'mokesh, and their gods that you're worshipping, that you're making deals with, will be for you for a trap. Vayihi kidaber malach Adonai et adrim ha'ilu, when this messenger of God spoke these words, they're called an isho, vayisru et ha'am et kolam, vayivku, everybody raised their voices, and cried, it's a God-fearing people.
But not enough.
What's that?
But not enough. Not fearing enough to do it themselves.
That's correct. But my question is, what stage are they? Are they a Bodhisattva stage? Where are we exactly in our area of the Jews? What is he bothered by? V'atem lo tichotu britli yoshvei azot mizbechotehem totiotum lo shamatem bekoli mazot asikem. What appears to be going on here is not the Avodah Zarah stage. The sin seems to be lo tichotu brit liyoshvei haaretz, do not make a covenant with them. Mizbechotehem titotsun, you shall smack down their altars. Lo shamatem bekoli. So we're at a very early stage. We may be immediately after Yeshua's death. We may be even towards the end of Yeshua's life, but that I do not believe that is correct. What's that? Oh, by Yishlach Yoshua, that's true, but that's a time warp. It's a time warp, because the first pasuk in Shoftim starts walk with by Yachari Modi Yoshua. So have to be careful, it's a time warp. And that's why there's a break, by the way. That's why there's a little space break between the two. Yes, yes.
Well, it seems to me that this is a catch 22.
Go ahead.
If they couldn't, for whatever reason, chase out all the people, then they don't have the power to break down their idols. If they don't break down their idols,
And their idols are going to seduce them into idol worship.
You know, so if Hashem was going to help them chase them out, but then remember in
Shemot.
Right, he said, I'm not going to chase them out all at once.
Right.
We'll have to do it slowly.
Correct.
If they do it slowly, then there is...
Exactly right. I'm bothered by this catch 22. What is God thinking? Are the people to blame? What have they sinned? What have they done wrong? It is unclear at this point, and that's what I want to raise. I'm going to go right now to Shemot. If you have the pages... It brings in Eben Ezra first, but I'll read the Shemot itself to you. I'm sorry, if you have a question, feel free to stop me.
can you from the text that the answer would be obvious, that in all those places where it says they didn't have enough strength to banish them, and then a little later it says, oh, they went, became stronger and they made them pay tribute, that agreement whereby we'll pay you tribute, you'll leave us alone.
Exactly right.
That's the kind of risk maybe that the Navi was like.
Keep in mind, by the way, that mas, if you take a look and say for Shmuel, is not a financial tribute, it is a human tribute. A mas is a mas ovei. You remember that speech that Shmuel makes to the nation about appointing a king and the dangers of appointing a king. And one of the things is, etc. A mosque, generally speaking, in that time was a manual mosque. If you go to the building of the Beit HaMikdash during Shlomo's time, it says, I'm not saying always, but generally speaking, when you think of mosque back in that time, the tax collector was a human tax collector. If you wonder about Adoniram, remember Adoniram was that bad tax collector during that, and they stoned him. It wasn't because he was collecting cash, it was because he was collecting people, and he went with an army with him as well to collect those people. So it's even more to the point. It's not only were they sharing an economy with the people, they were actually sharing human beings with people. So I agree with you, and I want to ratchet up one step farther. But for those who weren't here yesterday, I want to raise the issue that I raised last week, but I didn't resolve. But I want to shock you a little bit because there's a seeming contradiction. If we take a look in chapter 23 of Sefer Shmot, verse 29, it's talking about how this is pre-sin of the golden calf. Things are very good for the Jewish people right now. All plans are excellent. God is with them. They're going to go in and literally, I mean, lightning is going to strike and the Jews are going to conquer this land.
Which
but it says, what? Chapter 23, verse 29. Okay, what's your question? Before the calf. The golden calf happens in chapter 32, 33. This is before Moshe even goes up to the mountain. Before he goes up to the mountain. It's Machloket. Machloket. Whether Sefer Mishpat, whether Mishpatim happens before Matan Torah or after Matan Torah. But this little piece, this area, this narrative happens before Matan Torah, according to Ramban, according to most. That is, they have not had a Seret. It's even a question whether it was before a Seret Adibrot, but everybody agrees that it's before Moshe went up for 40 days to get the Luchot, because immediately after the Luchot, things all fall apart, and then God gives them a different speech about the Malach that will go in front of them, and it's not the same as this speech. Things have changed. At this point, things are wunderbar. Couldn't be better. And it says, after saying, I'm going to conquer them, and I'm going to wipe them out, and I'll go before you, I'll have no problem, it says, Lo agarshenu mipanecha b'shana achat, I will not wipe them out in a single year. Pen tiyeh ha'aret shimama, lest the land be fallow, or by void of people. V'rabat aleichem chayat ha'sadeh, and animals will come and take the land. Me'at me'at agarshenu mipanecha, I will conquer them slowly. Until you become many, like in Puravu, the Nachal Ta'at Aretz, and then you take the land. So wait a second, I have an immediate contradiction. In here, God says that He's going to make things go slowly, not because the Jews are doing the wrong thing, but because He can't afford to wipe out the what?
Practical. You can't. I mean,
the
people will be animals that
take over.
Exactly right.
Well, who would you rather fight, animals or people?
Well, what's interesting is apparently the animals are a serious issue. Why back then did animals, wild animals, and I think we're talking about leopards and lions and stuff like that. Why is God concerned about it? It's not only the fact that they're wild animals. God does not want to enter a state where the Jews are not ready to take over the land that they conquered. That is, simply conquering a land and then leaving it be is not what God has in mind for His lands. Not only, I think, because Chayat HaSadeh, but I think because Chayat HaSadeh are indicative of the fact that that's not... What's the purpose? What do you do? Put a little, put a little a tent on top of the hill and then call it your land? It doesn't make sense. It's not true. Whether what I'm saying has... I want you to know something. I'm not much of a fundamentalist. Whether any of what I'm saying has any implications in the 21st century, I leave it to your imaginations. I refuse to get into trouble. So, this seems to be the issue. So the question is, but wait a second, back by Shoftim, it says specifically that because you made a brit with them, that's why I'm not going to free up the land. So which is it? It's a little bit confusing.
Oh,
What?
What's the problem with
Why?
The code?
Why?
As a consequence of it being done slowly, you fell into a trap.
Ah, exactly right. And I want to show you that inside. What's interesting is Rashi, for some reason, the Mepharshim don't see this, say that when it's obvious, when it seems obvious to me. Let me take you what the Mepharshim say back in Sefer Shoftim. In Sefer Shoftim, it says like this. It's a very strange pasuk. It says, "Vatem lo tichrutu." This is in pasuk 2, verse 2. It's 2:2, verse 2, chapter 2. "Vatem lo tichrutu brit li yoshvei aretz." Don't make a deal with them. Mizvuchayem tichrutun. You should destroy their altars. Lo shmat mivlim azoisem. Begama marti lo gereishol tamitechem. Literally, that's past tense. Now Rashi translates it the following. It's on the sheet if you have it. What is Vigama Marti? He translates that as Va'ata Amarti. And now, because of what happened in Pasuk Bet, not because of Chayat HaSedeh, not because of this, now, because of the fact that you cut a brit with them, that's why I'm not going to send them out fast. Radak does the same thing. I've got to tell you, the Radak also says, do I have the Radak? I didn't bring down the Radak. But the Radak also says the same thing. They term Pasuk Gimel as an extension of Pasuk Bet, a cause and effect. If you ask me, it's exactly as you said it. Vigam Amarti. Don't you remember when I told you? Lo agaresh otam mitnechem, v'hayu lachem l'tzidim, v'loheihem yu lachem l'okesh. It's Pasuk Gimel that comes first. It's Pasuk Bet that happened because of it. It's a little bit backwards. What he's saying is, you're making brit with them. This is exactly what I told you. I told you I was not going to get rid of them so fast. I warned you ahead of time. The reason why I did that was not because I needed to, like, I don't know, tell you the future. It was because I was trying to identify a problem. You're going to go in, you're going to think you're going to wipe people out and immediately. I can't make it work that way. It's not going to work that way, which means inherently built into the structure of conquering Israel is the fact that I'm going to make sure that there are non-Jews, that they're the nations that will remain there for the right reasons. The warning for you is, now that you're forewarned, that you know they're going to be there, now you have to know not to make the brit. That's how the pasuk reads to me. Why the medieval Mepharshim don't go there, I have to tell, I don't know. It seems obvious to me. I've looked, I cannot find a medieval Paris that says anything like it. The Dot Mikra doesn't talk about it at all, when to me it seems black and white. That's how I would read these psukim. Because I told you this is going to happen, I left them there on purpose. Now you can avoid this problem. You can say in Sefer Shemot it says I'm not going to be megarish them in Shana Achat, 1 year. But the second year they would be divorced from the land. That's very difficult to say because, you know, the 3 million people waltzed into Israel. It wasn't going to be 20 million people in 1 year. The idea was as the population. In fact, the pasuk even says that as your population grows, so too will you grow with the land. When your population is appropriate to take over the land, that's when you take it over. Until then, they essentially have a right, again, I don't mean to be political here, but they essentially have a right to stay in Eretz Yisrael. Because better that they be in Eretz Yisrael than nobody to be in Eretz Yisrael. Again, I'm going to be political here, but that's what I read it. That's how I read it, and that's how I'm going to call this. By the fact that they're there, now you have to identify that you've got a problem. And the problem is, they're there. And if you could be aware of the geopolitical realities of the time, don't take it for granted. It's not really your country until it's totally your country. Until it's totally your country, it could easily turn around on you if you don't take my warning seriously.
And I understand the issue of a bridge. I don't understand the issue of destroying their mizbeach.
What do you mean? What do you mean by you don't understand?
How would we have had the ability to fulfill that while they're still living?
The question is, and that gets into a little bit what we discussed yesterday. Political pressure can be asserted. Again, I'm not trying to speak of the 21st century, but if you want to, you know, if that's what it is, that's what you call it. Just because you don't own a piece of territory, can't own a piece of territory because you don't have the population to own that piece of territory, or the strength to take that piece of territory right now, does not give you enough strength to apply political or religious pressure in that territory. Just like Adoni Bezek was brought to Yerushalayim, even though they didn't own Yerushalayim at the time, to cut off his fingers and his hands to make a demonstration, Avodah Zarah, I believe, the idea of what I think God was in fact asking an audacious thing of the Jewish people. You're not going to have the land. I don't care. You're going to assert maximum political pressure to destroy idol worship that you can. In fact, the Ramban goes further. He says, if you do destroy their idols, then and they are willing to give up Avodah Zarah, not to accept Shevet Mitzvah B'nai Noach. Ramban says, as long as they're willing to destroy their Avodah Zarah, that removes essentially the only problem that you have with them. So says the Ramban. and therefore you could actually leave them in Israel forever for all I care. That's what the Ramban says. Ramban's a little misupak. He says maybe it's just destroying their idols. Maybe they have to accept all Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. They certainly, according to Ramban, do not have to become Jewish. And by the way, he spreads the net to include, and I'm sorry, the Ramban, who agrees with Ramban, spreads the net to include Amalek. Should Amalek stop worshipping idols, you can make peace with Amalek as well. So says the Rambam. I'm sorry I don't have it, but the Rambam goes so far as to say it. I guarantee you, for those who were with me in my last year when we did David, there I had the Rambam right in front of me. The idea is not a nation is a problem. The idea is the way the nation behaves is a problem. According to Ramban, all you have to do is wipe out their Avodah Zarah. According to most other Rishonim, all you'd have to either make them Jewish, or most would say just make them accept Shevet Mitzvot Bnei, so they'd have basic morality. Only the Rashi says that all the nations, Canaan and Amalek, would have to be thrown out of the land completely. So I'll take it a step further. Even when they're allowed to live on the land, you still got to go into their towns and smash their idols, not only when you're trying to assert geopolitical control. It makes sense. I understand the ability to affect geopolitical control, even though you don't have the ability to move into to a piece of territory.
But if you're asserting geopolitical control, that sort of implies that there's interaction between
Correct.
Two people.
Absolutely.
Which would almost require some level of a bridge. Whereas, if you were just co-occupying
yes,
the land,
yes,
not cohabitating, but co-occupying the land, which would seem that that's what they were supposed to do, not have a lot of interaction, but just live there with them, then you don't have that geopolitical influence.
I agree with you. In fact, all of this is foreshadowed by the famous Avram Avimelech story. The first time he meets up with Avimelech, Avimelech steals his wife. Not such as an evening story. The second time they sit down and they create a brit together. The story that follows that brit, which is a brit, and here the word brit is carefully defined. A brit is not just a covenant between two peoples. What Avimelech says to Avram, Tasuli brit, with Zari, with Zari Acharai. A brit implies a permanent covenant that passes just your immediate dealing with each other, as you say, your cohabitation or your co-occupation of the land. I want to say, I'm not sure everybody agrees with the Rashbam, but I'd like to tell you what the Rashbam says. The story immediately following that brit between Avimelech and Avram is nothing else than Akedah Yitzchak. And the Rashbam calls it as he sees it. By Yehi Achar Adrayim Ha'elu, the Rashbam says that Akedah Yitzchak was a punishment to Avraham, that he would dare to give away the land to his son, that is, to commit the land that God gave him to Avimelech's son, and because of that, God said, you want to see about your sons that you're making bridge with? I'll show you what's going to happen to your sons. I realize that's harsh, but I don't think the Rashbam could be so easily ignored. There's a different level, therefore. I think right there it defines the difference between a brit and a working deal. A working deal is a temporary situation that you do because that's the status quo in the political situation of the time. A brit implies permanence. In fact, perhaps that's why Hashem says, that's it, I never thought about it, but now I'd like to go to Pasuk Bet, Perek Bet, Pasuk Aleph. Vayomer, Aled Chem Mitzrayim, Vavi Chem El Aretz Hashem Yishbati Lavotechem, Vaomar Lo Efer Briti Chem Laolam. Why does it have to tell us that? Why does it have to say that? God's not saying he's about to break a covenant, by the way. We never say, and now I'm going to break your covenant. Perhaps, and again, this is the first time I'm even thinking about it based on what you say, he's comparing the brit he makes with Bnei Yisrael, defined as a brit that you never, ever, ever break, to a brit that you're making with the non-Jewish people. How dare you make something called a brit, which is a covenant, which is everlasting, when you have no right to do such a thing, because that leads to all the kind of interactions which are unacceptable. So I think the way to answer your question is, there's a brit, and there's interaction. And once you get up to the brit level, the whole picture begins to change. You're not dealing, you're dealing with equals now, you're dealing with a future communication, and I think that changes the story.
Well, the next step after that, though, is that if they made a brit with the people, and the definition of brit includes permanence,
yeah.
Whatever relationship they established with the people is not designed to be permanent.
Why would you say that?
I mean, if you go back...
I realize that wasn't their design. They had a different design.
I understand, but they were originally told in Mishpatim that eventually the people would be thrown out.
Eventually, yes. So you think they knew...
So if they're eventually to be thrown out,
right,
then you don't enter into a permanent relationship with them, because then what you're essentially doing is saying, We don't care what Hashem plans.
You're looking at Bnei Yisrael in a very, very positive manner. They made a bit knowing that they wouldn't have to keep it for too long. But in my opinion, if it smells like a bit, walks
well,
like a bit,
well, I wasn't thinking
like
that
bit.
Way. Oh, on the contrary. I was giving them very negative.
Oh, that they were...
That they were creating a false impression.
False impression, like they're doing...
They were entering into a permanent relationship knowing full well that they weren't supposed to. They were disregarding Hashem saying, I will throw them out eventually. And they said, they'll be here permanently. What Hashem wants is not relevant.
Perhaps.
Don't the Avos set up a second model for a grid when Avimelech proposes, make a grid for me, so that's not for all generations to come. It's just for a certain number of generations.
That's not the way the Rashbam reads it at all. The Rashbam reads as a permanent child that once you establish those generations, like saying Ador Asiri. Ador Asiri doesn't mean Ador Asiri. It means Ad Olam is what it means. The way the Rashbam reads it, I'm not saying that you have to agree with the Rashbam. The Rambam reads it as a permanent brit that would be passed down generation to generation. And because of that, essentially, Avram almost lost everything. Had he not come through on the brit and showed that he was ready to sacrifice a child, an identification that the children are not his to make deals with, and the land is not him to make deals with, that he would have essentially lost the book ratio would be a lot shorter than it is today, and so would the rest of the Torah. According to the Rashbam, you can buy it or not, but he essentially holds Avraham under a flame. He feels that that was a failed test with Avimelech, and which was countered by the successful test of the Akedah. Look, it's rough stuff, but it has a certain logic to it, and it certainly fits into the words, right? And after this last thing, there's an Akedah Yitzhak. You can't. It's hard to ignore the Rashbam, as difficult as it is to look at as Avram would make a failure. And honestly, what would I have done if a soldier showed up in my house, what was his name, Pichol Sartzvao, and said, time to make a brit? I might have said, okay also. I would say it may have been his hardest test. What?
Anyway,
yeah, exactly right. I mean, it could be his hardest test, but you know what? Tests are not there to be failed. Hashem did not accept failure as far as that went. Okay, we have about 10 more minutes. I'm going to skim through chapter... not all of chapter 2. There are other problems, but... Oh, you know what? I promised I'd say something about the Ramban. So the Ramban says like this, in Shmot, about getting rid of people too fast because the animals will come. He says, Vayomer ha-Gaon. He quotes the Gaon. I'm not sure the Gaon is. I believe it's the Rambam, but I'm not sure. Because it's funny, because Ebenezer also quotes the Gaon, so I should have looked up in the footnotes who it was. I'm not sure they're referring to it. He says, Kitam pentirga alecha siman hazman shiishlacha tzira, which means God wanted to arbitrarily make it last that long. So he said, as soon as you have enough people, that's when you'll go conquer this area. Ki amar v'halo Hashem yachol lahamit chayat asadeh. It can't be that God was really worried about the animals. The animals were just like an indication that when the animals, when you had enough people, it would be an indication it was time to finish the job. Some kind of siman. Why? He comes across that because it can't be that God can't do whatever he wants with the animals. So we'll make the animals die out. There won't be wild animals. So the Ramban says, "Ve'ein lanu tzorach." We don't need this excuse. Ki Hashem lo yichadesh ot b'mofet. God is not making up miracles. The only time God changes nature, essentially, is to make sure that you believe his particular messenger at any given time. Moshe with the staff. It's a one-time deal. Changes of nature are one-time deals to make sure that you believe in the prophet who's coming to tell them. So essentially, Rambam, in those very short words, says a very important philosophical idea. God's game is not to change nature. Which means, Yericho fell down, it's true, but it fell down after everybody walked around and started stomping, and everybody could have said, well, there were seismic movements and things. Look, after Yericho fell down, it says, Vayal Ishne Go, everybody went into Yericho and fought hand to hand. So you ever wonder, why did everybody just have a heart attack? Wouldn't that have solved a lot of problems? I walked in, everybody's dead. That's the old question. What is the ultimate Jewish dream of the Palestinians? Just like the ultimate Jewish for Palestinian dream of the Jews. You wake up one day, and they're just not there. They're just gone. Chas v'shalom, we don't want to move them. We don't want to kill them. We're good. Look, Muhammad is gone. What are you going to do? Let's take the land. The Jewish dream. God doesn't work that way. He never will work that way. That's a philosophical.
Oh,
a reminder says why.
Yahweh.
Because Yahweh could have easily... just died of... My guess is that if you were on the spot, it probably, just as a guess, being a soldier, it would probably be dysentery. They woke up, and all of a sudden, they're all dead. It's not uncommon that entire... In fact, go back to Napoleon's. Go back to Napoleon's in Russia with the cold. They wake up, and...
I just saw it in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. They found it in Lithuania.
And what was it?
Thousands and thousands of skeletons.
I can tell you something. Israeli army, what you do in basic training is before you have kitchen duty, you get in, and the sergeant, essentially senior sergeant, looks at your hands. If your hands have any scratches on them whatsoever, no kitchen duty. So you think everybody would scratch their hands? Well, it's a fine line between working in the kitchen, which is a bad job, and running around like an idiot, which is a bad job. It's pretty much a lose-lose situation. But I remember the first time, and I didn't know what was going on. You know, me in America, I could barely speak Hebrew, so I walked around, and he said, show me your hands. I showed him his hand, and I had fallen down during a stretcher march, and I cut my hand open pretty nicely. So he said, go home. I didn't know why. He said, go to your barracks. I didn't know why, and I was happy to get out of KP duty, don't get me wrong. And the guy said, because essentially from an open wound, you could easily introduce dysentery and disease. So they're very careful about stuff like that. Probably up to modern times. I know that Napoleon's army, they had a problem because they had just invented canning with lead. Right? And the cans weren't so good. They weren't, I'm not an expert historian. And essentially they had a humongous amount of the troops that ate this poison canned food and dropped dead on the fields. I mean, if you have dysentery in the middle of the fields, you're not doing well. You know, it's not just like a case of, you know, you go to the bathroom and you call... take some Pepto-Bismol and call in sick, you're pretty much dead. So chances are Sinclair and his army died in a natural way. I'll give you another example, the most famous miracle, of course, and we're running short on time, so I'll just finish this idea quickly, is the Dead Sea, splitting of the Dead Sea. Wow, miracle. Anybody who's seen Ten Commandments knows super miracle. And take a look at Sefer Shemot. God made the east wind blow all night, hurricane wind blow all night. Why? I'm sure God could do it without winds. Because you have to give the, you have to, because if you don't have the ability to disbelieve the miracle, then you don't have any freedom of choice anymore. You know, if God comes down and says, now is the time to move to, I have my little bag packed for Israel, right? That famous bag that I put under my bed. And I'm waiting around for the sign. And God's going to come down and say, now is the time. It's not, it can't happen that way. It can happen, because if it did, you would have a free choice. Oh yeah, I'm a Zionist, big deal, you know. That doesn't mean anything. Believing in God when you have a miracle that can't be explained away, it takes away, you're a robot. You're nothing. And that really explains almost all miracles. I doubt there were many miracles that were ever non-explainable by some natural means, including Sinclair, including the splitting of the Dead Sea.
Nachshon the Jews, if it was supposed to be such an incredible miracle,
right.
Why would the Jews immediately
just jump right in?
How to get this Nachshon
guy? Obviously, it was a test of faith. You can't have a test of faith unless, you know. And miracles also, and another thing, miracles, even if you see the miracles, they don't make people from. And look at the first generation of the desert. Miracles, I think, wear off mighty fast. You know. Okay, I explained away the miracle. Okay, there's an Anan. And another thing about miracles, a miracle that happens every single day, because you always wonder about the Anan. The Anan's above. Isn't that an impressive miracle? The Anan and the Aish. You know what they call a miracle that happens consistently every day? That's called nature. The fact that gravity works, if anybody studied anything Einstein, curved warp space-time, that's pretty cool stuff. The fact that gravity works is a miracle. When something happens every day, I can create a formula for it, which makes my world a little more normal. If you have an Anan out there every day, so I create a formula of when the Anan comes and when it doesn't. I could create some formula to fit my natural, you know. That's not an unseen thing. Miracle, nature is, in fact, controlled miracle. And the minute a miracle becomes predictable, it's now nature. So those are a lot of things about miracles that I think we need to know as Jews. Don't expect the cold to come out. I didn't mean to be preachy. I'm sorry when we started. You know.
Don't
expect somebody to call out. For all I know, 9/11 was the call to move to Israel. I don't know, look at me, I'm a big hypocrite sitting here in America. So chas v'shalom, I'm not trying to give anybody criticism. But to say that God, to say that we're waiting around for a miracle to tell us to do something is a very risky, I think, philosophical belief.
So the
Ramban says that God, he doesn't say why, but why he'll get to in different places. He simply says God did not work that way. God does not kill off all the animals to make sure the land doesn't fill up. That's not the way God works. I would give a difference.
What is responding to?
Oh, apparently the Gaon was saying that the reason why they had to wait for there to be enough people is
so that
would
the
be a sign.
Take over. Oh.
No, that the animals not taking over was some kind of sign. I have a hard time reading the Gaon. I wish I could find it inside. Pentar Ba'alecha, he reads that as long as there are too many animals, you know that you're not supposed to finish the job. That it was some kind of, not that you couldn't finish the job right away, but it was giving you an animal indicator. As soon as the animal, like, gauge went down, that was when you know you were supposed to finish the job. And he rejects that. Because, why? Because he said, because it can't be that God couldn't have wiped out the animals all around. So what he did was, you think he's conquering them slowly. No. He's letting the animal population go down slowly, which tells you how much you're supposed to conquer. Ramban doesn't need that. Ramban would rather work in the natural world. The animals are animals, and they're going to be around there, and they're going to be leopards and Engedi, and they're going to be all kinds of animals. And as your population grows in a normal, natural, geopolitical or social political sense, you move with that. What's that? Exactly right. And as you increase in numbers, you automatically have an effect on them, which is a natural part of the way human beings live, and that's the way it should be. We just have a few minutes left.
But why isn't that Hashem's plan? Tell us when to finish the job. Why couldn't it be that natural, quote-unquote, natural way of doing it?
Absolutely.
Why couldn't that be his way of giving us the message?
Again, the fine line between nature and miracle.
Right.
Absolutely. No question. What the Gaon was saying was that God could have wiped out the animals right away and the Jews could have moved one person per hilltop. I think that's... I disagree with the Ramban. I don't think it's that just that they had to get rid of wild animals. I think what God was trying to say is that taking over land that you can't populate is idiotic. It makes no sense. It's not good because of wild animals, but it's not good because of any reason. It makes no sense. It doesn't make sense to conquer territory.
Maybe
they don't
have to be
for.
Ready in other ways too than just moving in.
Of course,
I mean,
they
have to be
and
ready
and
to
water,
deal
agriculture,
with it.
You know, Kodesh Baruch Hu said that, you know, I'm leaving the going, yes, you can learn warfare from them as well. You have to be able.
Okay. Now that's ran out of time as usual. That's the other difficulty, because if we go down, and this is where I'll finish off, and it's a difficulty. If we go down to Pasuk Chaf, chapter 20, 21 of chapter 2, it says, V'gamani lo osip lo rish ish mefehem min agoyim asher azav yosho v'amot l'man nasot ba'am et Yisrael. I'm also not going to get rid of these people to test you out. Hashomim hem ederech Hashem alech abam. See, that's a new reason. They're left there to make sure you stay from. I want to make sure you're not. That's a catch 22. I can get rid of them right away, and then of course you'll be from. But I want to leave them there to see whether you'll be from. That's difficult. And then the third one is in Tariq Yimel. If we go to verse 3, chapter 3, verse 1. Because they didn't know the wars that were first fought with Canaan. But they had to be taught war. The simple read of this is that war is a necessary evil. If I wipe out all the enemies, somebody will come from, I don't know, Africa, the Kushan, or somebody will come up from Mesopotamia, you won't know how to fight a war. That would be the simple way to read this. Again, the Mefarshim don't go with that. They say, what does it mean? And very difficult. They say, the first generation didn't have to know war. It's not leman dat milchama. It's leman dat that when you did the wrong thing, you're going to have to fight war. And if you do the right thing, you won't have to fight war. Again, Rashi and Radak both place this. It's all the same reason. If you make a brit with the enemies and worship their idols, that's why I send war. That's why I send the animals. That's why I send this. I have a hard time with this. What can I tell you? I have not found a satisfying explanation of why they all decide to go on this path rather than say, listen. Not only that, and again, I'll end right here. If you take a look at verse 20, it says, 21.
Which part?
No, I'm sorry, I apologize. In Perek Gimel, in 3. Ve'ela goyim asher niyach Hashem l'nasof am Yisrael. I left these nations there. Et kol asher la'yidu et nuchamot k'na'an. Rach l'man dorot b'nei Yisrael, etc., etc. Let's go to verse 3. Chameshet sarnei ha'plishtim. The plishtim who are living in Aza. Aza. Not that the Yehuda wouldn't get rid of, that they couldn't get rid of. And then call up Knaniyat Sidonim. So the other people he's talking about, yes, they were Knani, but they were all living in northern Lebanon. This is outside, as I mentioned before, it's outside the borders of narrow Israel, inside the borders of greater Israel. If I'm reading this straight, it says to me that God specifically left the northern borders and the southern borders with enemies so that people would know how to fight. But the middle, that's your job to take care of. That's not what Rashi says, not what Ratak says, not what Abravanel says. They're a lot smarter than me, but it seems to me that if we read the psukim more simply, we come up with a very satisfying explanation, especially in our understanding of Israel. Geopolitical process is slow. There are no quick miracles. There are no quick solutions. And what you need to know is not that why they're not there. You need to know now that they are there, how do I deal with them in a geopolitical way? The Jews failed to deal with them correctly. We'll see that failure next week, and Amir Tashem will also get to Ehud Ben Gera next week as well. Have a good night.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, it's a political. Well, it's a political process, but
elections.
It was not elections. Independent.
Like in Iraq, yes.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. Have a good night.
Like in Iraq, yes or no?
In some cases, in Yiftach's case, they want him because he was the best warrior. Very often, when the Shofet was a general, he was appointed de facto because he was the war leader, so he became the political leader as well.
So there were tribal leaders within each one of these tribal areas.
And they became the de facto Shofet. They may or may not have had influence outside of their tribe. Some of them did, and some of them did not. Usually it was the war leader. Even Gidon, a great prophet, a great Shofet, was also the war leader, who seemingly seems humble. Oh, I'm the smallest war leader, but nonetheless, he was in fact a war leader that God chose as the greatest of war leaders. There was a combination of a spiritual truth. But Yiftach was a war leader. Shimshon was essentially, I don't want to say, he was a guerrilla warrior who was very well known. Most of the time, it was a military affair, as
so
you would have expected.
The literal translation of Shofet is really
Shofet means a leader, political leader.
So what time is it, judge?
Also Shofet. Also Shofet, because okay. The judge generally...
Because that's what it's called in English, right, judges?
It is called judges, right. And it's a...
That's a false.
I think leader,
name?
I think leader, tribal leader. In fact, Shofet, from the word Shevet, changed the fey and the bet, and what it really means is the head of the Shevet is the Shofet. Judges, yes, they also judge in the sense that they were the jury and the, you know, they also had...
Are there any stories that we're going to come across where there's actually, you're doing any judging? Wasn't Devorah? She was sitting under the tree.
Yeah, Devorah was a religious judge as well. Othniel ben Knaz was known, although we won't see it as a religious judge, but most of them were not.
It was more in their leadership.
Now we know the lawyers make the best politicians.
Have a good night. So was that more fun than...
I don't understand.
You know, Zen, I'm sorry.
We'll talk about it more.
But class, okay?
Good night.
Pleasure. Have a good night. Oh, good. Glad you enjoyed it. Thanks for coming.
The test is that we don't assimilate. By leaving us there, we're tested so that we don't assimilate. We don't take their ways.
I don't know.
What is the test?
I think there is no test. If they are there... The fact is, yes, Leman Nasol. Yes,
that he says he's leaving it as a test.
Rashi changes it.
Rashi changes it.
He says they're left there because you failed the test. I realize that's not how it reads.
Yeah, the way it reads, you left him for. I think one reason that they're there, that they were there then, that they were there now, is that we attack each other when we don't have an enemy.
And you can read that into these psukim as well. You can read that in order to make sure that you know the difference between right and wrong. You have to be able to see wrong. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. And then who do they attack? The Frumkite, they attack number one.
Right.
They attack at number one.
But if
everybody's in a foxhole, they feel they have to pray. That's what it is.
Right. And
it's a terrible
as you can
thing.
See, things having it's the nature
no,
of human
It's a terrible
being.
Thing, though.
That's why we have the prophecies, because we're trying to the reason why things are written down as prophecies as opposed to history, which is not, I think, just like the Torah has laws, which will always be true regardless of the situation. The Navi gives us political and social instructions that are also eternal.
Yeah.
That is, it's not all the politics. It's the politics that is going to happen based on the nature of the world.
So will we always have this challenge until Mashiach?
Maybe after Mashiach. It could be that, according to the Rambam, Mashiach is just like today, except we get things right as opposed to get things wrong. but it's still a human endeavor to keep things right. The Rambam says
we're always going to have the endeavor.
Well, he says you always have temptations. The difference is there will be such a groundswell movement for morality and goodness is that the effect of the Yetzer Hara will become minimalized and nearly extinguished. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't take away the Rambam, even though the Rambam is not our usual view of a more miraculous messianic time, and it's a much more practical messianic time, he says we're good not because there is no more evil, but we're good simply because we've finally gotten to the point where there's such a large groundswell for good that it sweeps everything along in its path. Which is, I'll take either one, to be honest.
Right.
And I'll take goodness whether there's evil around or whether there's no evil around. I'm happy either way.
Okay.
I'm happy. Right. I'm peace is a good
thing.
And
you're saying Yehuda is not as important in these times, but he becomes very important. Malacha becomes very important.
He'll play a small role in Shoftim, but essentially disappear almost completely. And then we'll meet him again in Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel with David on Melach. That's where he comes to play.
That's where he comes in, right.
Yeah, yeah. That's where David has his greatest moment. That's where Shevet Yehuda has his greatest moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Have a good night.